From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Salt Lake City, Utah.
It's not my job to decide who's going to live or who's going to die. That's something that I've had to deal with morally and that I'm convinced of. Nothing is more clear in my mind that war is wrong.
Army medic Agustin Aguayo. Denied conscientious objector status, he was deployed to Iraq after the military ordered him to return for a second tour of duty. He went AWOL at his base in Germany. Today, he turns himself in. We bring you a Democracy Now! Exclusive and extended conversation with Agustin Aguayo and his wife, Helga. Then, Rocky Anderson, the mayor of Salt Lake City, will talk about war, protest, and the Bush administration. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Salt Lake City. Bush administration has slipped in a major change to the Senate bill on interrogations that would allow U.S. citizens to be detained as enemy combatants. Initially, the bill defined an enemy combatant as anyone who engaged in hostilities against the United States or its allies. But the definition has been expanded to include anyone who has materially supported hostilities against the United States or its allies. The Washington Post reports human rights experts express concern the language in the new provision would be a precedent-setting congressional endorsement for indefinite detention of U.S. citizens. Meanwhile, on Monday, a group of activists from Code Pink stood up in protest over the bill during a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. The activists stood with their backs toward the senators while wearing T-shirts that spelled out the phrase, "No torture." The activists called on the senators to remove a section of the bill that strips detainees of the right to habeas corpus. Three retired military officers who served in Iraq called on Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to resign during a hearing on Capitol Hill Monday. This is retired Major General John Batiste, who commanded the 1st Infantry Division in Iraq.
Donald Rumsfeld is not a competent wartime leader. He knows everything except how to win. Weak-minded and compliant subordinates who do not grasp the importance of the principles of war, the complexities of Iraq, or the human dimension. Bottom line, his plan allowed the insurgency to take root and metastasize to where it is today.
General Batiste went on to say the Iraq war has fueled Islamic fundamentalism across the globe and created more enemies for the United States. Retired Major General Paul Eaton also testified Monday and called for Rumsfeld's resignation.
The president is not well served by this Secretary of Defense, a man history will not treat kindly. So what to do? Replace the Secretary of Defense with a proven leader who has a vision to get the country's defense establishment back on track. The Army is in terrible shape. The Marines are not much better. A secretary who understands how to build alliances at home and abroad, who understands the operational art and understands the contemporary operating environment we live in.
Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times reports the Army's top officer withheld his required 2008 budget plan from Pentagon leaders last month in protest. General Peter Schoomaker did this to signal to Rumsfeld that the service could not maintain its current level of activity without billions in additional funding. Schoomaker is seeking a 41% budget increase for the Army. Meanwhile, the Pentagon announced Monday soldiers of the 1st Brigade, 1st Armored Division, will be extending staying in Iraq, and the 4th Brigade, 1st Cavalry Division, will deploy to Iraq next month, 30 days earlier than scheduled. The U.S. has 142,000 troops in Iraq. In other military news, the Pentagon announced Monday three U.S. Marines will go on trial for murdering an unarmed Iraqi civilian in Hamdaniyeh in April. In political news, a former college football teammate of Virginia Senator George Allen has publicly accused him of frequently referring to African Americans by using the N-word. The accusation came from a radiologist in North Carolina named Kendall Shelton. Shelton said Allen had nicknamed him Wizard because his name was similar to a former Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. Shelton also recounted an episode 30 years ago in which he and Allen and a third friend shot a deer while hunting. Shelton said Allen cut the deer's head off, asked directions to the home of the nearest black person, and shoved the head into that person's oversized mailbox. On Monday, Senator Allen called Shelton's recollections absolutely false, pure fabrication, and nonsense. But later that day, a professor at Alabama University came forward to say he, too, heard Allen use an inflammatory epithet for African Americans. The New Republic reported in April Allen had worn a Confederate flag pin in his high school yearbook picture. Allen's campaign against Democratic contender James Webb has suffered greatly since he was caught on tape referring to a man of Indian descent as a macaca. In other political news, a group calling itself the National Black Republican Association has begun taking out radio ads in Maryland and Ohio, urging African Americans to vote Republican. The ads have been widely criticized for distorting the historical record of Martin Luther King and the Ku Klux Klan.
Dr. King was a real man.
You know he was a Republican.
Dr. King, a Republican?
Democrats passed those black codes and Jim Crow laws. Democrats started the Ku Klux Klan.
White hoods and sheets?
Democrats fought all civil rights legislation from the 1860s to the 1960s. Democrats released those vicious dogs and fire hoses on blacks.
Seriously?
And the Dixiecrats remained Democrats and vowed to vote for a yellow dog before a Republican. Republicans freed us from slavery and put our right to vote in the Constitution.
In international news, the Israeli military is continuing to hold 18 Palestinian lawmakers after an Israeli court denied them bail Monday. The politicians also face possible trials for their membership in Hamas. They were seized in a series of raids in Gaza and the West Bank. The lawmakers include Palestinian Parliament Speaker Aziz Dwaik and several Palestinian cabinet members. Talib Asana, a Palestinian member of the Israeli Knesset, criticized Israel's move.
The decision of the court to continue of the arrest of the Palestinian parliament and ministers, and I think that's a political decision.
In Nepal, 24 people have died after a helicopter chartered by the conservation group World Wildlife Fund crashed. There were no survivors. On board were 17 Nepalis, a Finnish diplomat, two Americans, a Canadian, an Australian, and two Russians. This is WWF Director James Lee.
There were 24 people on this helicopter, including seven staff of WWF. Altogether, it represented some of the most important leadership of the conservation movement in Nepal, and certainly many of the leaders of WWF's efforts in Nepal and elsewhere. It is a huge loss for this organization, but also for conservation in Nepal, and of course for the families of these 24 people.
There's a development in the case of Tariq Ramadan, the prominent Swiss Muslim intellectual who was blocked from entering the United States to accept a teaching position at the University of Notre Dame. After a two-year wait, the United States has officially rejected his visa on the grounds that he once gave money to a French-based Palestinian charity. The United States claims the organization has ties to Hamas, even though it's a legal charity in France. Ramadan criticized the government's rejection of his visa, saying it was done for ideological reasons. Ramadan is now teaching at Oxford. In Charlotte, North Carolina, six people were arrested Saturday at the city's Human Rights Fest. Police shot one protester with a taser stun gun. Another protester, David Crane, was hospitalized with broken ribs and a punctured lung. Protest organizers said four or five police officers held Crane down and beat him. The police attempted to shut down the gathering, even though organizers had a permit. 700 people have already signed an online petition calling on the police to drop the charges filed against the arrested protesters. Organizers in Charlotte are planning to hold another rally Saturday calling for the impeachment of President Bush. Attorneys in Michigan are preparing to file a wrongful death lawsuit against the state's Department of Corrections over the death of a prisoner who suffered from a bipolar disorder. According to the Detroit Free Press, Timothy Joe Saunders died after spending most of his last 4 days with his arms and legs strapped to a steel bed in four-point restraints in a hot isolation cell. He was naked and soaked in his urine. He was 21 years old. Authorities haven't released an autopsy yet, but one expert witness called it death by torture. The Michigan Department of Corrections initially told his family he died in his sleep. Saunders is at least the third mentally ill prisoner to die under similar circumstances in Michigan in recent years. Also expected to be sued in the case is Correctional Medical Services, the private company that handles health services in Michigan's prisons. And in California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed a new law requiring the state's massive pension system divest from investing in some companies in Sudan. The bill is narrowly tailored to force divestment of only those companies that provide revenue or weapons to the Sudanese government and refuse to change their practices. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour through 80 cities. Today, we are in Salt Lake City, Utah. Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive. Army medic Agustin Aguayo applied for conscientious objector status and was denied. He was deployed to Iraq for a year. There, he refused to load his gun, no matter how dangerous the situation. Earlier this month, Agustin Aguayo went AWOL at his base in Germany after the military ordered him to return for a second deployment to Iraq. Today, Agustin Aguayo turns himself in to the military. His lawyer says he could face 5 years in prison. Well, yesterday, Agustin Aguayo and his wife, Helga, joined us in the studio in Los Angeles for an extended conversation. It was his first national broadcast discussing his situation. I began by asking Agustin to talk about his decision to join the military.
Yes, I signed my contract November of 2002. And when I did it, I was very optimistic. I was full of joy and eager to start. I wanted to do good things for my country. I wanted to help people. I wanted positive things in my life. I was eager to become a good soldier.
And what motivated you then to join the military in 2002?
Well, I was at a crossroads in my life. I felt like I had never really done anything for my country. And I saw it also as a way to improve my life. What really appealed to me was the college opportunities.
So you joined, and what did you join?
The Army.
And where did you sign up?
I was living in Palmdale, so I went to the recruiters there. And you actually sign your contract in Los Angeles in an office.
Mm-hmm. And so when were you deployed?
February of 2004, for a whole year.
And your feelings then? Were you eager then to go to Iraq?
Well, at that point, a lot of things had happened to me at that point. My training had really changed me. It pushed me into see the reality of war. Of course, I always knew there was a possibility I would go to war, and I was ready and willing to do anything that was asked of me. But at the time when I left, a lot of things were going through my mind, and I had to really search my heart and ask myself if I could take a life. And after the training made me ask myself that. One of the sergeants during the train up for the war, for the Iraq, he mentioned that nothing he had ever done was similar to that training. We were driving and pointing rifles out the windows, targets were popping up, and they were firing. And at that point, I really asked myself, I had a moment where I had to think and morally question what I was doing. And I reasoned and I found in my heart that I couldn't take a life. So I had to be public about that, share it with my chain of command. And that's when I decided to file for conscientious objection. They told me, you know, you're a soldier and you have to be willing and ready to fire, destroy, if necessary. So I had a great deal of trouble with that at that moment in my life. I felt that the experiences up to that point culminated in me asking, is this right? Is this moral? Is this what God wants? And then at that moment, I said, no, I can't. I'm going to deploy, but I can't take a life.
At the point you enlisted, at the point you signed up, this was before the invasion of Iraq. At the point you were deployed, the war had been going on for almost a year. Did that have an influence?
Well, it seemed the war from the beginning seemed absurd to me. People killing each other senselessly. I had not been in a combat, but what was clear in my mind was, you know, there's no way I can destroy another human life. That's not my place on this earth.
Were you a medic?
Yes, I am a medic. And many people find that troubling. They say, well, you're a medic. You're not there to destroy people. You're there to help people. And essentially, and it's true that I'm there to help people, but regardless of your job, if you have feelings that are against war, you know, your job's not really going to matter. Because in the end, you know, we're always told that we're all soldiers and, you know, we have to be ready and willing to take life.
To shoot.
Yes.
Now, when did you end up going to Germany? Because you went to Germany before Iraq, is that right?
Yes, I was assigned, after my training, I was assigned duty in Germany. So I left August of 2003.
With your family?
I left by myself, and a few weeks later they arrived.
Mm-hmm. So you deployed to Iraq from Germany?
Correct.
Where did you go?
In Iraq. I was in Tikrit, the city of Tikrit.
Saddam Hussein's hometown.
Yes.
And what did you do there?
My job is a medic, but while there, we did other things that were not medical. For example, I did a lot of guard duty. We had towers around the base, and we'd rotate in and out through there four hours at a time. So I did a lot of that, and a lot of radio monitoring.
Did you shoot anyone?
No, I never fired my weapon.
Did you carry it with you?
Yeah, I carried a weapon, but I didn't load my weapon when we left the FOB. And that...
The forward operating base.
Yes. And I try to keep that a secret from people, but one person found out, and he was very outraged. He was actually on vacation, and I was traveling with his group. And when he returned, his group informed him, you know, this guy didn't even load his weapon. And he was very outraged because he thought that I had put his comrades in danger by not doing that.
And what is your response to that?
My response to that is, well, when you're attacked in Iraq, you know, after the attack is over, you know, an explosion, an IED, I mean, there's nothing you can really do. You're going to look around and maybe you'll find one person, two people running, if that maybe. It's not my job to decide who's going to live or who's going to die. That's something that I've had to deal with morally and that I'm convinced of. Nothing is more clear in my mind that war is wrong, and I won't be a tool of war anymore. And the end result of war is the destruction of human life. Then governments use that to solve problems. And I think it's a great tragedy of our lifetime with so much technology that we still feel that that solves problems.
Did your supervisors know, your supervising officers know that you were not loading your weapon?
I think that person took it upon himself to share it with others. But it was never brought to my attention.
You never told anyone, not the people up your chain of command?
Correct.
Did you apply for conscientious objector status before you went to Iraq?
I informed my command that I would be filing, and then they started processing my work, my paperwork, as we arrived in the first few weeks.
Did you get interviewed by anyone?
Yes.
By like an
investigating officer.
An IO.
Yes. And his recommendation, which I brought and I wanted to share with you, was that he found me to be sincere, and he recommended, for the benefit of the Army and for the benefit of me, that I be separated. Other officers also recommended separation. However, when it went up the chain all the way to the Pentagon, to the board that decides, they decided against me leaving.
Army medic Agustin Aguayo will return to this exclusive conversation with him. He is going to turn himself into the military today after holding a news conference in a minute.
I've been down, cascading in blue without a sound. Now I've traded my black feathers for a crown. So feed me milk and honey, lay me down, lay me down.
A patriot is a person who loves his or her country. Who among you loves your country so much that you have come here today to raise your voice out of deep concern for our nation and our world? And we are here today to insist that those who were elected to be our leaders must tell us the truth. We are here today to insist that our news media live up to its sacred responsibility.
Black crows sampling Rocky Anderson. That's right, the mayor of Salt Lake City, speaking at a major anti-war rally protesting President Bush's presence in Salt Lake City. We'll be joined by the mayor after this conversation with conscientious objector, Army Specialist Agustin Aguayo. Yes, he's turning himself in today to the military. He applied for conscientious objector status, and against the recommendations of the investigative officer, he was denied CO status. He's been AWOL now for almost a month after he refused a second deployment to Iraq, ordered to return to Iraq despite the assessment of that officer in his case. I asked Agustin if this was unusual.
I've been told that usually when the IO approves it and the chaplain approves it.
Did the chaplain approve it?
Well, he said he seemed sincere. Those were his words. But he also stated that doing it around the time of the deployment made it questionable. And he said, well, you know, he seemed sincere, but it's so hard to judge a person by words, and that's pretty much what they have, just my words. And other people in my chain of command also supported me and believed me. I brought in witnesses. And I think that was the most powerful thing that moved the investigating officer. Him hearing from my fellow soldiers, them saying, yes, this man is an objector to war. He's not capable of taking a life. We believe him. And I think that's what moved him the most to recommend that separation.
Yet you were in Iraq for a year.
Correct.
You came out then? You left Iraq?
Yes. And they denied my claim. So when I came back,
When did you hear they denied it?
In September.
While you were still in Iraq?
Yes.
And how did you feel?
Well, I felt like they were denying my conscience. Like they were telling me, no, you're not an objector to war. I felt that was like the equivalent of telling someone, you know, you're not Catholic or you're not Jewish, you know. You say you are, but you're not really that. And I felt very troubled, and I informed my chain of command that I would try any legal means to fight that. And I did. When I returned to Germany, we hired two attorneys, and they told me, your case was mishandled. You have the right for the army to open your case again and review it. And indeed, that happened. And this takes months and months. And they reviewed it again, and they denied it one more time. This decision came February of 2005.
Six.
Oh, 2006. And the board that reviewed it decided 2-1. Two against leaving and one in favor. One supported me. So the case was then, I'm fighting it in federal court.
But they deployed you again.
They tried. So what happened was my immediate supervisors, they did all they could to get me out of that deployment. But in the end, the higher chain of command reasoned that I was a soldier. I was denied conscientious objector status. Therefore, I had to go.
Where were you when they said you had to deploy again? It was recent, wasn't it?
Yes, I was. Actually, my immediate supervisor told me all along. After I was denied, he had a meeting with the chain of command, and he told them, I recommend that he doesn't deploy again. We need to find him another job. And they didn't agree with him. So he kept me informed. He would tell me, he would go to meetings and he would tell me, they want you to go. They want you to go. There's nothing I can do. I've tried.
So what day were you supposed to deploy to Iraq?
My unit called the formation that I was to report to September 1st. And at that point, I had already notified my chain of command that I was not deploying. The officer in my platoon came to me a week before, and he said, I'm worried. I want to know what your plans are. And I said, sir, I decided long ago that I wasn't going to be a part of war anymore. So he said, well, you're going to have serious consequences if you don't go. So I want you to take the weekend and think about what you're going to do. Of course, I had already made my decision on moral grounds. So he was very concerned, and he informed a group of people. But I think in the end, they since I had always followed all the rules, they thought I would eventually just conform. And the day they called the formation, I tried to call my supervisor right before the formation to tell him I wasn't going to be there. So I missed him. He didn't answer my call because he was busy. So then I missed the movement. And the day after, I turned myself in.
Where?
In my home base at the MP station.
In Germany?
Yes.
And what happened next?
Well, I had already told them I wasn't going, and I showed that I wasn't going by missing the movement. And they came, my unit came and picked me up from the MP station, and they started making the arrangements for me to be on the next flight out. So at that moment, I realized that my actions weren't, my words weren't enough. It wasn't enough that I was saying, I'm against war, I don't believe in this, I can't take part, I won't be a tool of war. That wasn't enough, I felt, at that moment. So then I had to make myself unavailable for that deployment. So that's the only reason I left. I'm turning myself in. The consequences are more acceptable to me than actual deployment.
So tell us, though, what did you do in Germany? Your unit came to get you. They brought you to your house to get your things?
Yes.
And what happened?
They brought me to my house, and I told them, one of the sergeants that came with me, I told him, I've already made my mind. I'm not going. And he said, well, that's not for me to decide. So he was following orders from the chain of command, which told him, you know, take this guy to his house. He needs to gather his stuff. So I began to gather my stuff, and then in a moment, in a second, I exited my apartment and left.
How did you leave? The military, the other soldiers were in your house with you?
Yes.
So how did you leave?
They were in my living room, and I left through my bedroom, through one of the bedrooms.
In the window?
Correct, the window.
Your family was there at the time?
Yes.
I wanted to bring Helga, your wife, into this conversation, Helga Aguayo. Were you home with your daughters?
Yes.
How old are your daughters?
They're 11.
Twins?
Twins.
So what happened when Agustin came home?
Well, I was very distraught. So I was crying. I mean, it was my worst nightmare. Most soldiers that refuse to go just get arrested and get court-martialed. And I couldn't believe that my husband was confronted with being forced to go to Iraq. So he started pulling things out from the back of the apartment, his duffel bags and Kevlar and stuff of that nature. And then I didn't see him come out any longer. He didn't come out anymore. And my heart dropped. And I was very upset. And I eventually went to the back to see what was going on. And one of the bedroom windows was open, and he wasn't there. So I told the soldiers, the sergeants, he's gone. I think he got out the window. And they got very upset. One of my daughters was playing video games there with us. The other one was skating in front of the apartment building. And they ran out the door, and I ran behind them. They were a few steps ahead of me. And I asked my neighbor, I said, hey, have you seen my daughter, my other daughter? And she said the sergeant chased her down the street. So I got very upset, went down the street, and started calling for my daughter, and couldn't find her anywhere. And I found her hiding in the bushes because he had grabbed her, and he asked her, you know, where's your father? Have you seen him? Where's your father? And so she asked me, you know, where's my dad? What's happening? And I explained to her the situation, and it was very upsetting for her. After that, they started coming to our home, banging on the door. They searched the house 3 times, which I found out later was a violation of my rights as a civilian. They didn't have a search warrant. So they came into the house, searched the house. They were very harsh with their words. They said that if they found my husband, they would shackle him, they would put handcuffs on him, and they would take him by force. They would put him in a D-cell until the moment came where the plane would take him to Iraq or Kuwait. And they were just extremely harsh, trying to get me to call him, which I cooperated, but he just wasn't answering his phone, which I completely understand and support. I have seen the transformation in my husband. I saw when he enlisted, I supported him. He thought he could do it. But the way I see it, until the moment that he started training to kill, because effectively that's what they're training to do, kill, he changed. I remember getting letters from him from basic training about how upset he was when he entered the gas chamber. It's part of the training. They come in with masks, and he wrote a really detailed letter to me saying, this can't be right. People were killed like this. World War II, how can I be a part of this? It was a slow transformation, but I saw it. I've been married to him for 15 years, and I know he's sincere. And I know that he's doing the only thing that he possibly could. You have to understand, he's followed every rule. He's done everything that he was supposed to do. His rights were violated as a conscientious objector. He didn't mention that when he was in Iraq, he had CO status. And as a CO, you're supposed to get duties which less conflict with your conscience. However, he was put on guard duty when he wasn't supposed to.
But I thought that they had denied the conscientious objector status.
But before that time, they're supposed to treat you.
For the 6 months that he was there as a conscientious objector, they gave him jobs that he wasn't supposed to have. So as a true conscientious objector, he never loaded his gun. And he was put in danger without a loaded gun. And then once he was denied his CO status, which interestingly it got denied June 1st, and he wasn't informed until September 1st, he was then sent out on patrols. Immediately, as soon as they found out that he was denied, they started sending him out on patrols. And when he came back, he was determined to continue the process legally. He's just done everything he possibly could. And if he's truly a conscientious objector, then he had no choice but to refuse to go to this war, this deployment, this time.
So why are you turning yourself in? We're doing this interview Monday here in Los Angeles. You're turning yourself in when we broadcast this interview on Tuesday.
Yes.
Why?
Because I feel that I want to resolve this issue in my life. I am a member of the armed forces. However, I'm against war. Therefore, they need to, they're going to court-martial me. And I want to start this process. I want to be free from what I'm feeling. I feel that I'm trapped doing something that is wrong.
Being free might mean going to jail.
Correct.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I feel like I've always been a great citizen. I've never been in any kind of trouble. And it's sad that that's going to happen to me. But I feel that in the end, I'll be a better person. And I think things happen for a reason. And because of this experience, I can do positive things for others.
Are you concerned they could still deploy you to Iraq?
Well, that's on my mind as well. However, I feel that given how the outcome of these last few weeks, they won't deploy me.
We hope.
What kind of support have you gotten along the way? Are you alone in this with your wife, Helga, or have you gotten groups supporting you?
I've found a great number of people that have found out about my situation and are compassionate and understanding and with words. And with their presence, they have told me, you know, we support you, we're here for you. We believe in you, and that's more than I could ever ask for, because understanding, I mean, that's our human need, to be understood, to be accepted. And I found a whole world of people that are against war and that agree with me.
Helga, your daughters, how are they doing?
They're okay. They understand the consequences of my husband's decision, which I support. The way that we've explained it to them is that this will be the last separation that we'll have. They're happy. They're actually happy. Because they have seen the transformation too. They've seen, you know, my husband enlist and the conscientious objector feelings surface, and and get crystallized and just see this person that stands up. The greatest lesson that we can give our daughters is to stand up for what you believe in. And they have certainly learned that lesson through my husband.
Paul Boyce, an Army spokesperson, said in the Los Angeles Times, "I would encourage the individual to get with his chain of command. This is when you were AWOL. There are many other ways to address these things without going AWOL," he said. Your response, finally, Augustine.
That at the moment I left, I felt I needed to do that. I needed to show that I wouldn't be available for war. And I want to face the consequences. I want to resolve this issue. So to him I say, well, I tried everything, and now I'm turning myself in. I'm a good person. I'm just an objector to war.
I want to thank you very much for joining us, Augustine and Helga.
I'd like to add something.
Yes, Helga.
If anyone wants to support us, my husband has a website, which is aguayodefense.org. And on there, they can see the background, all the legal documents. And if anyone wants to donate to our cause, we've incurred a lot of legal expenses. There's a donate tab on there that they can click on and help us.
And if Augustine is imprisoned, what will you do, Helga?
I will try to start our lives. I will get a job, take care of my girls, and be independent, try to. Right now I'm living with my parents, so I intend to start building our new life and just wait for my husband with open arms.
Your last thoughts, Augustine, before you make your way to the base where you will turn yourself in.
I want to thank all the people that have helped me and support me. It's been a wonderful feeling to know that I'm not alone, that many soldiers feel the way I do, that many soldiers want to better the situation, but this way is not the way.
Augustine and Helga Aguayo, speaking to us in Los Angeles yesterday morning. Today they'll hold a news conference, and then Augustine will turn himself in to the military. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by the mayor of Salt Lake City, Rocky Anderson. Stay with us. The theme from the Battle of Algiers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're traveling around the country to 80 cities in this Breaking the Sound Barrier tour. Independent media is what we are celebrating. As we leave Salt Lake City today at 11:30, we'll be in Boise, Idaho, at Boise, the university there, Boise State College. We'll be at the Student Union Building. And tonight we'll be in Boulder, Colorado. Tomorrow we'll be headed to Santa Fe. Then we'll move on to Taos and Albuquerque, and on Friday in Denver, Saturday in Lincoln, Nebraska, celebrating KZUM. And in the evening, we'll be celebrating KKFI in Kansas City. On Sunday, we'll be in Baltimore, Maryland.
But right now, Salt Lake City. It was here that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made headlines last month when he likened critics of the war in Iraq to those who tried to appease Nazi Germany during the 1930s. In a speech to the American Legion Veterans Group, Rumsfeld referred to the period before World War II and said, quote, "Some seem not to have learned history's lessons. I recount that history because once again we face similar challenges in efforts to confront the rising threat of a new type of fascism," he said. Well, just one day after Rumsfeld's speech, thousands of critics of the war in Iraq made their voices heard with a massive protest here in Salt Lake City. Among them, Salt Lake's Mayor Rocky Anderson.
Our nation has engaged in a tragic, unnecessary war based upon categorically false justifications. More than 100,000 people have been killed, and many more have been seriously maimed, brain damaged, or rendered mentally ill. Our nation's reputation throughout much of the world has been destroyed. We have many more enemies bent on our destruction than before our invasion of Iraq, and the hatred toward us has grown to the point that it will take many years, perhaps generations, to overcome the loathing created by our unjustified illegal invasion and occupation of a Muslim nation. What incredible ineptitude and callousness for our president to talk about a crusade while lying to us to make a case for the invasion and occupation of a Muslim country. Our children and later generations will pay the price of the lies, the violence, the cruelty, the incompetence, and the inhumanity of the Bush administration and the lackey Congress that has so cowardly abrogated its responsibility and authority under our checks and balances system of government. We are here to say we will not stand for it anymore. No more lies, no more preemptive illegal war based on false information. No more God is on our side religious nonsense to justify this immoral, illegal war.
Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson speaking at an anti-war rally in Salt Lake City here last month, one day after Donald Rumsfeld and one day before President Bush gave major addresses here. Mayor Anderson joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. So you joined an anti-war rally and spoke out against President Bush as he came here.
Yes, actually, this is the second year in a row we did this. We did it the prior August as well when President Bush came to speak to the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention.
The American Legion's response to you, not just an anti-war activist, but the mayor of the city.
Well, I actually met with the national commander of the American Legion, and our views obviously differed a great deal. He took the position that you cannot oppose the war and support the warriors. I think that is so off base when we're fighting such an unjustified, illegal war. We do support our troops, and we want to see them brought home. It was interesting that he took that position after the American Legion had formally opposed President Clinton's commitment of troops to stop the genocide in Kosovo several years ago. So it seems like they think that when there was no justification, I actually asked him, why are we in Iraq? And he couldn't tell me other than that he thinks that there was a tie between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. It's very curious that these people are trying to keep the voices stilled in this country, that more and more are seeing that we were lied into this war and that it needs to come to an end. We're creating more enemies, more hatred toward this country.
Rumsfeld's comments that comparing critics like you to Nazi appeasers.
Yeah, that was really something. That shows, I think, how absolutely desperate these people are. And whenever Rumsfeld talks about this war, really anything. I think that we need to harken back to his promise to this country in trying to sell this war initially, that in his view, we would be there maybe 6 days, maybe 6 weeks, but probably not as long as 6 months. I think we need to remember what these people were telling this country at the time and how absolutely that wrong they have been at every turn.
Fox News went after you
that was interesting.
For this protest. Yeah. You were on their morning show?
I was on a morning show, and I thought that they were interested in hearing from me, but actually they were sort of a caricature of themselves. They wouldn't let me finish a sentence. They went on the attack. I tried to give details when they asked for specifics, and all they wanted to do was quibble. And I pointed out, you know, this war was sold to the American people, largely by Fox and other members of the media, and we were lied to. We were lied into this war, and in terms of the execution of this war. I did. I talked about that they have helped lie this country into this war, and they continue to lie. I mean, look at the Jessica Lynch story that was sold to this country. Turned out none of what we were told, and even the source, the Army source for that story, has never been disclosed. I think the mainstream media, this has been a segment of our country's history that we will look back upon with great shame and embarrassment, given how the American people were fed so many lies, both in terms of the run-up to this war and the execution of this war. And I think, though, that the American people are certainly getting it. When you look at the polls, but it's just so sad that there's been this tremendous lag time.
Well, perhaps part of the problem of the corporate media is that they reflect the spectrum of opinion between the Republicans and the Democrats. And leading up to the invasion, there was hardly any difference. You had Kerry and Edwards
supporting
the invasion.
That's a very narrow spectrum. Yeah.
You're a Democratic mayor here in Salt Lake City. What do you have to say to the leadership? In fact, you were just in New York, weren't you, for this Clinton summit?
Yes, for the Clinton Global Initiatives. I was there to present on global warming, and they're doing just amazing work in that area. But what do I have to say about the Democratic Party? I'm ashamed, really, of how little leadership there has been. There's been just tremendous timidity on the part of the party generally, although there have been a handful of exceptions. But, you know, we had one member of the United States Senate vote against the Patriot Act. The blank check that was given by Congress to this president, I think in total abrogation of the role of Congress under separation of powers and under the power to make war, to declare war, they gave that away to a president that didn't have his facts straight and I think was manipulating the intelligence to sell this war.
Mm. You also, before you were mayor of Salt Lake City, were a lawyer who represented prisoners. In the book that we've just published, Static, we have a section on you where we talk about who were the prison officials who set up Abu Ghraib. One of them came right here from Utah.
Two
he was
of
the head
them,
of the Department of Corrections,
yeah.
Lane McCotter.
Well, McCotter and Gary DeLand, both of them had been directors at different times of Utah Department of Corrections, and not a great record in terms of human rights or civil rights in the corrections department during that period of time. And I did represent a number of inmates whose rights were clearly abused, whose needs were disregarded, and in one instance, a mentally ill inmate who was not given his medications. He should have been forced with those medications because he was deteriorating so badly. You don't give somebody in that situation the choice as to whether they're going to be medicated, and especially you don't respond with such violence as they did. They went in forcefully, took him down, stripped him naked, and put him in a restraint chair, tightening the straps around his ankles, his arms, kept him there naked for 16 hours. No chance to go to the bathroom. I've heard from inmates that they were sitting in their feces and urine sometimes for days in that chair. And he developed during those many hours without any examination by the psychologist or psychiatrist who had ordered him being restrained.
This was Michael Valente?
This was Michael Valente. And he developed blood clotting when they got him up to take him in the shower after 16 hours. He threw a blood clot, had a pulmonary embolism, and died.
And this was under Lane McCotter?
That's when Lane McCotter was the director, yes.
Then he moves over to Santa Fe and runs a private prison system there, and the prisoners are actually pulled out because of the abuse of the prisoners.
When Lane McCotter was here and Gary DeLand as directors of corrections, they were utilizing also a restraint board, a metal board where they would tie people down by their wrists and ankles. I'd get calls from people mentally ill. One man had slashed his eyelids and with a razor blade, rushed to the hospital. Instead of receiving any compassionate care, any therapy, any kind of normal mental health services, he was simply strapped down naked to this metal board.
It's called four-pointing?
Yes, he was four-pointed. And so, you know, the disregard for people's rights in this country, I think the natural evolution of that is the treatment of those who are incarcerated under circumstances like we saw at Abu Ghraib, like at Guantanamo. I think that there's a very dangerous trend in this country for people to say we don't believe in torture, that we believe in human rights, but we're willing as a nation too often to look away when it's somebody that we just don't want to deal with. And these are horrendous circumstances. National Commander of the American Legion actually told me that there was nothing that happened at Abu Ghraib that's not happening on every campus in this country. I just found that absolutely appalling.
Or frightening, one or the other. You are not running for a third term, you've announced,
yes,
to take on issues nationally like this, torture, human rights, and environmental issues. What have you done in Salt Lake City around environmental issues?
Well, we've been focusing very much on local air quality problems, those sorts of things, but primarily on climate change issues. We have a climate protection campaign that's been very aggressive. We committed in our governmental operations on the eve of the 2002 Winter Olympic Games to abide by at least the Kyoto Accord goals. And those are set for 2012, that we accomplish what would be a 21% reduction from 2000 levels in greenhouse gas emissions, global warming pollutants, by 2012. By last year, after only 3 years, we surpass that goal. And I think the message here is this can all be accomplished, and you can save money in the process. This myth of the Bush administration that somehow it's going to be economically devastating to reduce our global warming pollutants, it's just the opposite. We need to grow into this new economy and move toward greater conservation. Corporations have saved billions of dollars in doing this and doing the right thing. So cities around the country now. We have over 300 mayors who have signed up for these kinds of measures.
Mayor Rocky Anderson, I want to thank you for being with us. That wraps up our broadcast here in Salt Lake City. Tomorrow we'll be bringing you a Salt Lake City soldier who is walking across Utah for peace. That does it for today's broadcast. I'll be in Boise State University Student Union Building today at 11:30. Then tonight we'll be in Boulder. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hubdo Caduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuru Richin, Frank Lopez, Jen Youth. Special thanks to Chuck Skurich and to David Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org for tour details. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.